I'm really surprised that there wasn't at least one person who reached out to you and said, I am willing to debate this.
Not one.
Wow.
It's the same feeling of intactivism. The very things that we're not allowed to talk about should be the clue to how this system is working.
You're listening to The Brendan Murata Show.
In this episode, I talked to James Lowen, an incredible documentarian and YouTuber whose career has spanned multiple movements. James began documenting the early gay rights and transgender movement. He then went on to document the intactivist movement and has probably documented it even more than I have. James also has been following recently the freedom movement, the movement against COVID-19 lockdowns and restrictions, and has also documented the detrans movement. So we're going to talk a lot in this episode about James's journey, because I'm really interested in how an artist changes over their career and how it is that James has documented so many interesting things over the years and what he's learned from that, what's changed for him. And so we're going to get into all of that in this episode. Now, because we do get into some stuff around COVID-19 lockdowns and restrictions, the second half of this episode is going to be only available to subscribers, because general social media platforms get a little censorship heavy when it comes to that material. So I'm interested in talking to people from all points of view. James's views are different than mine, so I'm going to be talking to someone who has a different perspective than me, but I'm interested in those conversations, and we're going to have one on this show. So without further ado, here is James Lowen. First, how long have you been doing videos and photography work?
Well, it's kind of a lifelong thing. You know, I was drawing before I took pictures, and I was struggling for realism. And when I got my first camera at age 10, I felt like, oh, this is it. You know, this is what I've been wanting to do. And also, as a child, I was organizing backyard plays and casting my brothers and sisters and neighbors as, you know, the actors. And then I happened to find that a friend of mine's father had a movie camera. And when I saw that, I thought, oh, this is it. You know, it'll be a one-time, get their performance on film, and then I don't have to worry about them, you know, showing up for the next performance. So age 14, I got a movie camera, a Super 8 movie camera, and started making movies. And I've been sort of stills and movies ever since. But the video at first was so poor. You know, the technology for video when I was in high school was just, it was a curiosity. And I remember at the time thinking, oh, I don't want to work with this. This looks horrible. But then, you know, as it progressed and we got into home video, then it really became much more more reasonable, and also the quality improved. Once it went high definition and then 4K, it was like, oh, this is it. This is beautiful.
So to give people an idea, what year did you start doing video stuff? When you mentioned the technology was not there. The technology wasn't all the, like the camera that I'm doing this podcast on is a nicer camera than even some of the cameras I worked with in film school. So what was it like in your day, and or what exactly was that day?
Well, I can't remember the date. It would probably have been like mid 80s. And the camera I had was a JVC Super VHS thing that you sat on your shoulder. It was sort of like prosumer, but it was very expensive for the time. And it took these huge VHS, super VHS tapes. And then I edited on two VCRs.
I know some people who worked that way growing up. And in my day, it was the mini DV. That was the big breakthrough technology. Yeah. So you got started with this. What is it you were filming initially? What sort of things was your camera pointed at?
I was shooting events. I remember shooting the demolition of a building here in Vancouver. I went to various gay pride events and shot, you know, footage. I was hired to shoot a couple of weddings, and just sort of, you know, looking. I remember always looking for subject matter.
And I think something that a lot of people know you from is your work filming activists. And so at what point did activism and and sharing the various events and demonstrations that people were doing and interviewing people, at what point did that start to come into the picture?
When I got my first serious SLR camera in the early 70s, I went to a protest here in Vancouver that was held by the Gay Alliance Toward Equality. And it was in front of a bar that had refused service to some people because two men kissed in the pub. And so I covered that with still black and white still photos, the protest of that. And I was very interested in protests. That's, you know, been a long time interest of mine.
What drew you to it?
Well, a couple of things. One is knowing that the media at the time wouldn't cover it. So I felt that. So yeah, that was the first inspiration to cover those things, was because nobody else was. And I felt that, you know, that would be of some historical significance to have those photos.
You're interested in part because no one else is covering it. But what is it that you think that the people not covering it were missing about the significance of these events or the things that you were filming?
Well, in those days, you know, I was also aware of the fact that certain subjects wouldn't appear on TV. And so, you know, I was very drawn to that which was forbidden or censored or, you know, that the mainstream wouldn't cover. And I had, you know, some idea that, you know, if I did that, that the resulting photographs would have some value in time.
Do you still have all of that early material? Because I imagine that you're correct on that, that those photographs probably would be very valuable to people interested in the history of that movement.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I'm also a minimalist, and I have I'm also a very severe critic of my own work. And I've gone back several times, even as a child, drawing and just destroyed stuff that I created because it wasn't good enough. And unfortunately, some of that early work is no longer there for that very reason. You know, I looked at the pictures and thought, oh, I could have done better. You know, it's just kicking myself because, in fact, you know, I was contacted by somebody who was writing a book about early gay rights activism in Canada. And he was really mad with me when he found out that I had destroyed some of those pictures. So, yeah.
That's too bad.
Yeah, I've learned a few lessons. And, you know, certainly one I would pass on to any budding journalist or photographer, is keep all your records.
I am an archivist. I have every film and video project I've done going back to high school on various hard drives. And it takes up a lot of space, but there's that part of me that's like, maybe at some point I'll want it. It might be important at some point.
Absolutely. I have another horror story where in high school, I've made a short film for a drama class. And a couple of the other people that were involved in the class saw the film, and they, one in particular, a fellow I was in my class, his name is Mark, and he had an idea for an elaborate film shot in black and white Super 8. And, you know, I shot it. I didn't understand it. I had no idea what the point of this film was, but it was fun making it. But years later, you know, again, purging, I just thought, you know, why do I have this? But I've kicked myself many times since that I can't even believe I'm saying these words, that I disposed of it. And I truly regret that because, you know, there are some things you don't know that you're going to appreciate later, you know, subtle things that are in a piece like that. So, yeah.
Well, I'm grateful that so much of your work has made it to YouTube, because one of the great things about YouTube is it lets others in the world be your archivist, so to speak. So it's out there in a form that will be preserved in some way. And I'm curious how much of the filming you did was pre-YouTube, because I know you're involved in the early gay rights movement. And I think the thing that most of my audience knows you from is your work filming the Intactivist movement. So was there anything between that initial filming of the gay rights movement and the discovery of Intactivism?
Yes. When I was in high school, I had a very interesting biology teacher for grade 12. And at the end of the year, his name was Mr. Strom. At the end of the year, we had done all our work, exams and everything else. And he had a very thought-provoking slideshow that he gave us. And he just showed a number of slides that were of all different subject matter, just really to get students thinking. And one of them was a blonde woman getting on or off an airplane taken in the early 50s. And he asked if anybody knew who this was, and nobody knew. And he said, well, this was Christine Jorgensen. Does anybody know who that is? And nobody knew. And so he then said this was one of the first people to undergo a sex change. And that information ignited me. I had never heard of such a thing. And I thought, I need to know more, you know, and I went to the school library and found her autobiography and started reading it. This was this time when I had my first DSLR. So I thought, well, this is my calling. I'm going to photograph people who have changed sex. And that led one thing led to another. And very quickly, I was meeting people who had transitioned. And so my earliest work really, you know, serious body of work that went on for quite a few years is portraits of transsexual people. And that is coming in very handy right now because I'm working on a piece about detransition and about the harm of gender ideology in school. And so I'm going to be using a lot of those photographs to illustrate something I'm going to narrate.
You have a very interesting arc to your work because you started with the early gay rights movement, and then you mentioned early transgender movement, and then into activism, and then you were very involved in the anti-lockdown or protest against various COVID lockdown measures, and then the detransition movement. And I think for a lot of people, they wouldn't necessarily put all of those different ideas together or see them as related. And so I'm curious for you if there's been a through line to all of them or something that you feel like these all have in common that drew you to all of them.
It's a really good question, Brendan. And I puzzled over this, you know, myself. And I think, you know, really the motivation for all of this is a bit of a sense of outrage. And perhaps some misguided outrage too. You know, at first covering of transgender people, transsexual people was a feeling. I had met somebody who was trans, and she was really struggling in those years. This is the early 70s to have the surgery that she wanted. And it was very hard. It was much harder to achieve in those days. And so I felt that, you know, I had a sense of outrage about the fact that people were marginalized or treated as less than. And that goes back to childhood, actually, because, you know, I was a small child. I was, you know, advanced. I was put a year ahead in school. So I was the smallest kid in school in my class. And then there were a few issues around that and bullying and such that, you know, I think the sense of outrage is really core for my activism. Mm-hmm. And I think that's true of, you know, many people who, it seems every time I interview someone, you start talking about childhood, you find stuff about abuse. And sometimes, like I interviewed someone yesterday, and right off the bat, it was just intense. And actually stuff that's not going to be in a final video because, you know, of the nature of how specific it is. But that's been a theme throughout life too, is just this abuse generally. That's probably the main thread through all of this is the sense of outrage, the sense of trying to right some wrongs and also to deal with something that's, you know, that's forbidden, that most people don't want to look at.
Is there a source of that outrage for you, or is it something that you're drawn to in the stories of others?
Oh, no, it's very personal. Hmm. Yeah.
What about it is personal for you?
All of it. You know, like the subjects that I deal in having to do with gender, with sexuality, with genital mutilation, it's all personal. And, you know, so is the sense of outrage and the sense of trying to right the wrongs. And I'm not trying to, you know, be a narcissist about it. I'm trying to apply this to life generally and hopefully make things better so, you know, the children of the future don't have to deal with the same stuff. There's an element of comedy I just thought of that, you know, has sort of surfaced several times, and that is that, you know, I've sometimes just shown up with a camera and shot an event. And, you know, people don't really know who I am. You know, I've just found myself in some unique situations. And then they start ordering pictures, or they, you know, they're really glad that they had a photographer there, even though they hadn't planned for it. And so, you know, that's been a theme running through all of this as well, is that it's really organic for me. Like, I'm choosing what I want to shoot. And we're, you know, very separate from being hired to cover something. And yeah, so it's comical sometimes, because, you know, first they're like, well, who is that guy with the camera? And then it's afterwards, oh, James, we're so glad you were here, you know, which is, I don't know, it's funny.
It's amazing the doors that you can open by just showing up with a camera. People like to be on camera, and they like to have what they're doing be seen as important enough to be worth filming.
That's changed, though. You know, in the old days, a camera came out and people would like, oh, no, I don't want my picture taken. I don't want to be in this. But now it's bizarre. You hold up a camera and people walk up to you and say, oh, could you take my picture? And they don't even want a copy. They just want to be photographed. It's weird.
I think it's a social media change that now everyone has a camera in their pocket, and everyone's promoting themselves with that camera. So if someone else has a camera, then it must mean an opportunity for them to sort of share their personal brand, if you will, with the world.
Yes.
So you were filming the early gay rights movement. You were filming early transgender transition stories. And at what point did you discover the Intactivist movement?
I discovered the Intactivist movement quite by accident, or perhaps by fate. I was in a bookstore in Vancouver and had gone there to buy a specific book or periodical, and got to the counter, and I was waiting for the clerk, and I felt a tap on my shoulder, and I turned around to see who it was. There was nobody there, so I thought it was my friend who's always playing one of those, you know, tap you on the other shoulder and stand over there trick. So I whipped around the other way looking for my friend John, and there he wasn't there. And I thought, well, that's weird. But then I saw the title of a book, The Joy of Uncircumcising. And I went, oh, I've heard about this, but I didn't think it was legitimate. So I went and picked up the book, and obviously it was really well researched. It was a very fascinating book, and I bought it and took it home and read it backwards and forwards for a few days. And then in the back of it were the lists of activist groups, including No Circ and No Harm. And so I wrote to them and found out about a protest in California in 1993, California Medical Association, held by No Harm. So I got my car and drove down and covered that. And that was the first, you know, connection with Tim Hammond, Marilyn Milos, Wayne Griffiths, Jim Bigelow, all the people, the wonderful people, John Erickson, all the people that were involved in that early movement for Intactivism. And I was electrified by that, because once again, it was ripe for somebody to document, and there was nobody else doing that. That was a really momentous event. And strangely, I was putting those pictures together some months later for a display, and I had a television at the time, and it was tuned to PBS, and they had a show about angelic in inspiration or something. And I, you know, not a religious person, and I don't really think much about, you know, angelic beings. But what caught my ear was hearing, as I'm putting these photographs down, this woman who was being interviewed say, well, sometimes it's not like being visited by an angel. It's more like being tapped on the shoulder and turned around to see something in this life that you're supposed to see. And I was like, whoa. And, you know, I've had a few experiences in life like that that suggest that there's something else, you know, beyond the veil. And so I try to, you know, follow my instincts as far as all of this goes, and just keep, you know, doing the work that feels right. And the work as an Intactivist documentarian came very, very naturally, you know. And actually, it was Marilyn Milos's work with the symposia, where she had all these incredible people speaking. And I know at one of them, they had done some audio recordings of the speeches. And a friend of mine who was an older Intactivist lent me the tapes from the previous, the first symposia, symposium that Marilyn had had. And those tapes were my education. You know, I was hearing incredible speakers, including James DeMeo and Ashley Montague. And the list goes on and on. They're just most incredible lineup of scholarly people talking on this subject. And there was so much to it. And, you know, like many other intactivists, I went down that rabbit hole head first. And, you know, for several years, that's all I was doing was just ingesting all of the information that I possibly could. And then I realized that it would be a good addition to this movement to record these presentations on video and also to interview the people personally. And that's what I attempted to do. And then, of course, YouTube appeared and immediately then was an outlet for all this stuff. And so all of these things kind of, you know, converged just at the right time. And it was a good climate for doing this.
I'm really amazed by that tapped on the shoulder story. Before you mentioned seeing the angelic documentary on TV, it sounded like the book itself sort of tapped you on the shoulder and said, this is something to pay attention to, which my experience getting into this information and this movement was very similar. It's sort of a moment that I've described in other interviews where there was an intuition, at least, to explore this further. So I'm interested in the fact that there was something like that for you as well.
Sorry, Brendan, I was just going to say, could you refresh my memory on the details of your experience?
Oh, I'm surprised you don't remember, because I think I talked about it when we first met. When I was up in Vancouver, which actually I'd be curious to see the interviews that you shot. Maybe when I see the footage, that'll be in there.
It's there.
But I talked about how I was going through a period where I was examining a lot of things in my early life. Patterns, emotions, things that were traumas, things that were just belief systems I no longer needed. And I was letting go of them, and I would run across the issue of circumcision. And every time it's like, well, there's not really anything I can do about that. So I'd sort of push that down, out of mind, out of sight. And it was during meditation that I had a very cold sensation in the body, and all my energy drained down to my belt, and I just had the word circumcision in my mind. At the time, I was really into Zen meditation. When I was living in Los Angeles, that was the first time I was near large meditation groups that I could go sit with. And so it was after that that I went home and started researching. And then, of course, one of the first things I found was this idea that they didn't use anesthesia when they did the procedure, and that trauma is stored in the body in a very particular way. I was like, okay, maybe that has something to do with this. And, you know, about a month and a half later, I was starting work on my documentary. So, yeah. And then, of course, I met you, and you were on the first tour of meeting people, interviewing them for the film. And your YouTube channel was very educational, because there's a video you have on there of Van Lewis talking about how when he was in his 20s, he first discovered this issue and went, in his words, like a little crazy. Like, it was just sort of maddening to see what had happened and all the feelings coming up. And I thought, okay, like, I'm not the first person to feel this way or to think about this or have this experience. And meeting you was also very educational, because you were, I think, one of the first people I met who talked about filmmaking and using the camera as a form of activism. And I didn't really think of what I was doing as activism. I was just like, I'm making a documentary. I love making films. This is some information and things that I think people could think about more. And the way that I have of communicating is film. So I'll take this thing that people should know about that they maybe don't know about, and I'll share it with more people through my camera. That was pretty much the extent of it. I don't have a question in there. We're just tripping down memory lane now. But actually, I'll add a question of what that experience was like for you when we first met. And go ahead.
No, it's interesting. You know, speaking of memory lane, I remember when you came up the hallway to my apartment, and prior to you arriving, Marilyn Milos had called me and she said, oh, you know, I've been contacted by this guy, Brendan Morata. Do you know anything about him? You know, is he trustworthy and all that? And of course, you know, people are cautious about people joining us and, you know, making documentaries because there were, you know, people out to also slander and make, you know, try to get the worst of us.
Sure.
And I just remember, you know, after we met, I was so impressed by your enthusiasm for it. And you know, you seemed so focused and so sincere. And I, you know, wholeheartedly supported what you were doing. And then, you know, realizing the extent of what you were attempting to do, you know, to make a feature documentary at your young age, because I think you were 24 years old at that time, and the amount of time that you spent on it, which was something like 6 years. Is that correct?
I might have been 21 when I, no.
Maybe.
How old was I? 23? I might have been 24 by the time I met you. Hold on. Let me just, quick math, 2011. Yeah, right.
Okay.
23.
So, you know, appreciating where a person generally is at that young age and how much of a project I knew that that was going to be, you know, that how you'd set your sights on something quite large.
I didn't know how big a project it was going to be, which is probably a good thing. I might not have done it if I knew how much it was going to be.
Wow. You know, the finished product was incredibly impressive and, you know, certainly has had a long, long life and probably still doing good work, I think. So, you know, congratulations on having seen that through to the end. It was just a fantastic event, a fantastic product.
Thank you. Yeah, it's still out there. I mean, I get the numbers every quarter on how many people have seen it, and it's still going. It's still going strong. So
good, good.
I think I made it, though, with that intention that it would be an evergreen film and that it would just be the film that if someone wanted to know something about this, they would go to that. And that would be the thing of, oh, have you seen it? Because every movement or issue has something like that. Like that was sort of the mindset that I had of, okay, like, well, we need one for this. And that's something I can do. And also, when I first started learning about this, I had your videos and I had a bunch of books and there were some websites that I think even at the time were a little dated and could have used a fresh polish. And now I think there's a lot more, which is good. But
well, you know, Brendan, it's always my hope that these things we create are going to inspire other people to take it to the next level. You know, or to use that information to branch into another direction with it. And I think your film has that inspiring quality, you know, because there is so much, and an issue like this can be looked at from so many different angles. And yeah, so I think that's, you know, one of the great achievements of your film is I think it's inspired so many people.
I still want there to be more. Like, I think there's room for 20 documentaries on this subject. And so you say, well, we want our stuff to inspire more people. I want there to be more people doing what you're doing. I want more people to make documentaries. It's my attitude's always been, I mean, how many documentaries are there on climate change or racial issues or civil rights or, you know, like there's hundreds on some of those. So why not this? If we think this issue is as important as those, if it's on the level, there should be the same amount. But getting back to the work that you've done, I'm curious how over the course of your filming of Intactivism, you've seen the movement change. Because it sounds like you were filming from 80s, 90s. When did you?
93 was the first event.
So that's from 93 to present day. That's almost 30 years of filming. And I'd imagine there's a lot that you've seen over that time in terms of growth and change and things that have happened. So I'm curious what in that stands out to you.
Well, I think at first, you know, there wasn't that much change other than seen in the 90s, there was a fair amount of mainstream media attention to the issue, very positive attention. And I think it was before the powers that be got wind of the fact that there was a growing movement. And so, you know, various news type TV shows would cover this. And I saved a lot of them. I've got a huge archive of these shows, which I think are incredibly valuable because they really show this arc of public opinion and media attention. But the big change I saw, I think, was the advent of the Bloodstained Men and Brother K. And and also, of course, Jonathan Conte. It's interesting because, you know, there are certain things that happen that I'm going to suggest something else. It's a very unusual connecting point of some of these issues. When I first started speaking with other intactivists, I found three or four who all said that the first time that they heard any criticism about circumcision was from a 1968 novel by Gore Vidal called Myra Breckinridge. And that's a novel about a transsexual. And in the novel, the main character expresses her distaste for the American practice of mutilating baby boys. And so it was interesting in the early 90s to connect with other intactivists and find that that had been also the first, it was for me the first time I had seen any public criticism of circumcision. It was a real eureka moment. And so I think there are events like that that kind of fuel awareness, you know, on a grand scale. And even though it was just a half page, you know, rant in this book, it had enough power to inspire others to start looking into the subject. It was very interesting, you know, attending these the symposia that Marilyn put on, because, of course, we'd meet all of these incredible people and such a diverse group who are intactivists. Then I remember Tim Hammond had, I decided I was going to make a short documentary on the intactivist movement. And so I was gathering as much information as I could. And it was all a bit sketchy, you know. I had an idea that I was going to show this at an event that was honoring Marilyn. Can't remember the date, probably late 90s, early 2000s. And Tim Hammond had this picture of these two masked protesters, a man and a woman, somewhere in California, and they were holding up protest signs, and nobody knew who they were, or at least Tim didn't know who they were. And so I included this picture in this little documentary I did, not knowing who these mystery intactivists were. But it turned out this was Brother K and Carol Ann, and they were really the first protesters of circumcision. Not entirely the first, because Van Lewis was also there, and John Erickson was also a protester, but each in their own neighborhoods, in their own time, in their own way. And so when Jonathan Conte arrived on the scene, I remember seeing him in an early type Zoom meeting with Bay Area intactivists. And I was just like, I was amazed. I was like, who is this guy? He just came out of nowhere. And apparently he left Florida to come to California to be an intactivist. And I thought, there's really a song there. You know, this is poetic. People are now like inspired to become activists for this. And then from Jonathan's original work, you know, going out on the street by himself with his signs, and Richard Dunker from Great Britain standing on the street in his bloodstained uniform that he made, all of this inspired. I'm jumping ahead here, maybe, or, you know, I don't know, I'm just jumping all over the place, but it's a very rich history thinking back on all of this.
Well, you're telling the story through time rather than, or through theme rather than chronology. Because it sounds like the biggest change that you mentioned you'd seen was the advent of Bloodstained Men. And Bloodstained Men, the seeds of it sounds like, was one of the earliest protests that you just happened to find a photo of where no one knew who this person was. And it didn't reach its full form or the visual symbol that's kind of come to define that group until recently. But it sounds like what you're saying is that the seeds of it were there really early. Yeah. And there was sort of a confluence of different things, of Richard Dunker's outfit and Brother K's early protest and someone like Jonathan Conte really wanting to get involved in this to the point where he would move across the country, that created that particular thing. But I'm curious, what about that you think is so transformative or different? Like, why? Because there's a lot of things that have happened over the course of those 30 years. Why would that be the thing that's so significant?
Well, a couple of things. One is it's taking it to the street. And that's very different from what we have now online or, you know, more sort of academic circles. It's very in your face. Brother K has elaborated on the significance of the bloodstain and how powerful a protest symbol that is. And he calls it perhaps one of the most powerful protest symbols in history. And I think he's right, because it's so visceral. You know, it ignites people's passions, even if they don't know what it is. It makes them a little bit crazy. And it's very provocative. Does that answer your question at all, do you think?
It does. No, I'm curious also about how, so it's transformed the way that activism is done. I was also curious if it's transformed the people involved in some way, or if there's, or what part of that you felt like was really significant. But it sounds like for you, it's the power of the symbol. That's the, which Brother K, when he was on this podcast, said the same thing. He said that when he saw the bloodstained symbol, that was a moment where he just knew that this is the thing that would propel this issue forward.
Well, you know, and of course, Brother K has told this story, but I'm going to tell it too from my perspective. the use of the bloodstain in the U.S., you know, originally I'd seen this picture of Richard Dunker standing on the street somewhere in London, I think, and, you know, arms akimbo and legs spread and, you know, just and bare feet. And the bloodstain on the white coverall. And Jonathan saw that picture and he called me up and he said he was thinking about making some bloodstain uniforms for the protest at the annual convention of the American Academy of Pediatrics, which was in New Orleans at the time, coming up in New Orleans. And he asked me what I thought about it. And I was like, yeah, that's a great idea. He said, how many should I make? And I said, well, how many do you want to make? And he said, well, I'm thinking like, you know, maybe he said six or something like that, five or seven. And I said, well, I think an odd number is better. And I think seven is better than five. So I would say seven. So he made seven bloodstained coveralls and he brought them to New Orleans and he put one on, took his shoes off to, you know, in homage to Richard. And then he was uncertain about whether anybody else would put them on. But immediately, you know, he had six other men put the bloodstains on, and they all stood out in front of the convention center where the Academy of Pediatrics was having their convention. And we had been so accustomed to these arrogant doctors coming out of this convention center, you know, every time they had a break, and, you know, they would just sneer at us, and one or two would quietly have a conversation with us, but most of them just, you know, even giving middle fingers. But when the seven men were standing on the street, armed fingertip to fingertip in the median, in the center of the road in front, the conference broke for lunch and the people came out and they were agog. Mouths dropped open, cameras came out. It was a moment. And my only regret is I was shooting stills at the time. I don't think I shot any, I didn't shoot any video of it, but, you know, that would, I would love to see that. That would have been great to see video of that as well. Anyway, that was, you know, very significant. And Brother K really was inspired by that when he saw and felt that. And it was a while before I actually put on a bloodstain. You know, I was always taking pictures and I was, you know, I didn't necessarily want to. I like to dress neutral when I'm shooting something like this so that I have the opportunity to go to a passerby and say, what do you think of all of this, without them thinking that I'm necessarily part of it, because I think I'll get a better, you know, more sort of open conversation with them. But when I made a bloodstain and put it on to join the bloodstain men on the tour, I realized, you know, what that feels like to put that on and go out in public, and how these people who had done it, how they, you know, I imagine how they felt as well, you know, and it's a very interesting feeling. It's a, you know, for me, it was a bit of trepidation. It was a bit of, you know, this is taking some courage, but then it was like empowering, very empowering, because you see the reactions of people and, hey, it's just a bit of paint on some fabric. That's all it is. But it's symbolic. The symbolism is so powerful. And backing up a little bit, another interesting aspect of this is that at David Wilson's annual General Integrity Awareness Week in D.C., and Jonathan brought bloodstained outfits to that, and he had either made more or other people had made them as well. And there was going to be a woman who's also an activist, Patricia Robinette, and she is a victim of American FGM, female genital mutilation, done to her as a child in the hospital or in a doctor's office. And so she was going to put on the bloodstain. And to everyone's surprise, several other women put them on. Whoa, there's so much controversy from that. People saying, oh, this is terrible. Women shouldn't be wearing that. How dare they? They're taking away from the men. They're taking away from Patricia. But what I realized when I started talking with these women, that they also were victims of abuse in childhood. And they also identified with the abuse of the men who had been cut as children. Yeah. Sorry about the breakdown here, but, you know, sometimes it really, it's overwhelming. Feelings it's overwhelming okay. Sometimes. It's all good.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of, you know, a lot of controversy about the women wearing the bloodstain, but once they did, it was done. It was going to keep going. And, you know, to the people who had a problem with it, well, that's tough. It had a life of its own.
I didn't know that Patricia was the one who started that. Her story and her book are just really powerful. I met her when we were filming the documentary, and her writing about this has been very influential to me because it helped me separate what aspects of this issue were things that related to genital cutting and what things related to men. In other words, there's a lot of aspects of this issue that are gendered, that are related to how we think about and treat men. But what she showed me was that there's a lot that's really just about trauma and not gender. And that a lot of the things that people will say, oh, that's just how men are, it's like, no, that's how people who've experienced trauma are. So it makes sense to me that there would be women who would emotionally relate to this issue, because trauma is trauma and everyone experiences it the same way. I mean, I say that it is unique to each person, but everyone, the trauma is not gendered, or it doesn't have any particular background or class or anything like that. We're all humans and animals, and it's processed the same way, even if it's might have some unique particulars.
Truly. Yeah. Patricia's story was very moving to me as well. And I'm so grateful for the work that she's done. Yeah. And I'm glad she's still at it too. You know, she's a survivor and a warrior.
Now that you've told that, I'm thinking I might have to try to get her on the show, because her story is great and might be worth sharing. So you actually went on tour with the Bloodstained Men, and I know a lot of your later Intactivist work is from those events. I'm curious what your experience was on the road with them, what drew you to that, what your feelings were along the way.
I was recruited
What was that?
I was recruited by the general, Brother K. And, you know, he said to me, James, we want you on the tour. You know, you'd be a great asset to the road crew. And I think they had done quite a few of them before I actually joined. And I'm really glad I did because it was the most unique and wonderful experience. I've lost track of how many trips I did. In the years before the fake pandemic, I think I was almost on the road all the time, and it was wonderful because, you know, I live in Vancouver.
We're going to have to come and circle back to that throwaway line that you just inserted there, but that's coming.
The Blood Amen experience was like, that's a whole chapter of my life that I will always cherish, you know. Brother K organized this so beautifully, like everything, all the details taken care of. So really all I had to do was leave my home, go to the airport, get on the plane and land wherever and meet the other members of the road crew, get into the rental van, drive to the hotel, go to sleep, get up, go to the first corner where we're protesting and start shooting. And it was very interesting because we were usually a crew of 7, 9, 13, 14 people. And, you know, I'm traveling with people that some of whom I've met before, some of whom I've only met online, and others who I've heard about but never met. And I must say that it was so congenial. It was you know, a bond was formed between us. And, you know, we're all doing this crazy thing every day of appearing suddenly on the street corner in the middle of nowhere or the middle of somewhere in these bloodstains. And of course the people in their cars are just, you know, completely baffled. And, you know, we meet the people, they come out of their cars, they come and join us and sometimes bring their children. Other people come, with anger and they want to, you know, berate us for what we're doing. And we had a lot of very interesting conversations, as you know, from these videos, and sometimes an actual turnaround of, you know, somebody who was against us. And, you know, within the context of a conversation, they understood the issue and left, you know, with a different perspective. So what I was starting to say there was, you know, I always had a dream to go to the southern United States and tour the South. But of course, I never had the idea that I'd be wearing a bloodstain outfit and touring with these people. And it was so wonderful because, you know, I left Vancouver at the end of the summer, and I went to this sort of endless summer of, you know, the southern states with beautiful hot sun and Florida and the ocean. And, you know, we were working hard. We weren't, you know, it wasn't a vacation, but I think for 1 year there, I barely saw any winter or any rain. It was just an incredible experience. And, you know, coming back with all of these videos and all this footage, and then doing my best to put out as many videos as I possibly could. And you know, I see that as having a sort of a double purpose. One is to try and educate those who are seeing them for the first time about, you know, what this issue is. And the other is to bring the activists together and to honor them and what they're doing and encourage more activists to join us. And that what Brother K has done is absolutely the most powerful event in intactivism next to Maryland's symposia. I think those two things are the most impactful. The energy that's gone to that has done so much good in two ways. In those two ways I mentioned, one of waking people up and also of giving birth to new activists.
Thank you for listening to part one of my discussion with James Loewen. Part two is going to be only available to subscribers, so please sign up at brendanmorata.com/show-subscribe, or you can just go to my website and you will find a subscription link there. I hope to see you in part two, where things get very interesting. Thank you for listening to The Brendan Morata Show. If you like this episode, please subscribe and leave a positive review on whatever platform you listen to podcasts on. If you really like this show, please become a supporter of the show. Go to brennanmurata.com/show and become a monthly paying member. Supporters get access to special bonus content and episodes only available to them, so become a supporter at brennanmurata.com/show. Thank you again for listening to this episode, and I will talk to you all later.